Welcome to Pickle Me This, the officially unofficial podcast for Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, we're talking about Season 1, Episode 2, Lawnmower Dog. Here's Aaron with the recap.
On this episode of Rick and Morty, the Smith family struggles with their dog Snuffles' bladder control, with Rick inventing a helmet that grants the dog near-human levels of intelligence to get Jerry off his back. Rick then concocts a scheme to enter Morty's math teacher's dreams to incept the idea that Morty should have perfect grades to keep the boy's parents off his back. While eventually successful, Rick returns to the Smith household to find Snuffles, now going by his chosen name of Snowball, has developed super intelligence, canine battle armor, and has liberated pets across the globe while enslaving the newly servile humans. Rick uses his dream inception technology to convince Snowball that oppressing humans will only lead to further heartbreak. Snowball then leads his newly freed army of super dogs through a portal to establish an independent world of neo-canines.
So what'd you think of the episode?
I thought it's a really good episode of Rick and Morty. Before we go further, I want to mention that like this is the first episode that has a post-credit stinger, and I did not find that out until I was halfway through season two. So anyone that's just joining us for the first time or maybe has made it through Rick and Morty and has always switched off at the credits, shame on you because you've probably got another hour's worth of content to go through at the end of the credits. So fast forward through the credits if you don't give a shit about artists. And watch that stinger because they're pretty good. They're pretty good. I thought that the episode itself is good. It combines a hallmark of Rick and Morty pop culture elements that we're all kind of familiar with and is in the zeitgeist in fun and entertaining ways. I thought some of the visual gags were really funny. Like the first time Rick puts the helmet on Snuffles' head and he says, go to the bathroom, and the dog like walks off kind of like the way like Babe, does his calm routine with the sheep, and he goes off screen and then you hear like a toilet flush and he comes back. I thought that was fun. And then in the dog dystopia that the episode kind of closes with, the dumpster's full of human testicles. The picture of the dog or the scene of the dogs playing poker and on the wall is a picture of the humans playing poker that has and also picture of dogs playing poker. So it's like a dog poker inception.
Dogception. Yeah.
Yeah. Dogception. I thought those were all great. All great.
My favorite part is when they're coming out of the dream sequences with Scary Terry's help. And he gets to the Minotaur and he says, those two pieces don't belong together, and slices them in half.
Right. Like
good stuff.
Yeah. The whole, like him, like breaking through all the different dream levels and shutting all that shit down on every single level of inception. That was pretty good. Yeah. Speaking of Scary Terry, I wonder, it's so close to Sammy Terry, which is like, I think you were maybe a little too young for it, but that was like the central Indiana version of like the classic horror host, the local broadcast on Friday nights would show King Kong and Godzilla and the Blob. And I know that there's a lot of Midwest connections to especially Dan Harmon, a lot of, he's from the Milwaukee region. And I think a lot of that, I wonder if some of that cross-pollinated because it's just so close, but also it could just be rhyming Scary Terry. You can't use Freddy Krueger.
Right.
But yeah, no, it was really entertaining.
It's a pretty callback heavy episode too. I don't know if this will continue going forward, where they do a lot of callbacks, but a lot of the lines with the, you don't know me, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, the dog saying, oh, I think he's saying I love lasagna. And they bring that back with Jerry at the end.
Yeah.
I like callbacks. I think they work really well. And the show knows how to use them.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of them this time.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other themes that I sort of noticed, a couple of themes, obviously, and they're sort of siloed up around like Inception and Lawnmower Man. On the Inception side, you have sort of a lot of shots at fandoms. And I don't know how far to read into this, but there's, stuff. As someone who has recorded an entire podcast on figuring out the plot of Inception, I feel like I should take it personally when Dan and Justin very much seem to be against that idea. Like, you're not smart if you figured it out. It doesn't make sense anyway. It's a stupid thing. Don't talk about it. But, like, the whole culture around it kind of got that way. So,
yeah.
Like, I feel him.
Yeah, there was like, and well, it must be a really double dose of irony because like the classic Rick and Morty copypasta, which is like, you know, Rick and Morty is a very intelligent show and you have to have a high IQ to understand it, like, is a little bit of the same kind of variety of the what went around in like the fandom culture around Inception, where it's like, oh, if you like Inception, you must be a really smart person, or it's kind of like the dumb action movie version of like a thinking person's movie. Sure. Which I actually like, you know, as I liked Inception. I think it is like a puzzle box movie that definitely has a solution. Mm-hmm. But it's that's an interesting thing to Dan, because like I think I've heard enough Harmontown to know that he's definitely ranted about Inception a time or two. But like, you know, it's a comedy show, and I think those it's like comes from a real place of like, you know, maybe obviously, especially when we're watching it the first time, there are a few like, I'm not sure what's going on here and if this all tracks through, that might be cleared up on multiple watches. But like, then, you know, why should you have to watch something multiple times to get it? But on the other hand, like also making movies is hard. And I know that the writing stories is hard, and getting your point of view across accurately is hard. And what the fan community does with that work once it's out of your hands is out of your hands and sometimes regrettable. So I'm sure a lot of it's played up for comic effect, and, you know,
for sure. But I also think like there's an element of that to anything that captures the imagination, including Rick and Morty, like you were saying, like, those fandoms exist because something has so enthralled them, they can't help but talk about it. They can't help but think about it. And that's what Rick and Morty's going for. Right. And I think it succeeds on that level. So it's almost, I wonder if they'll ever address like some sort of meta Rick and Morty fandom kind of thing within the show. Because it's become very big in the past few years.
For sure. And, you know, as far as Inception, I thought some of the more clever jokes is when they're talking about how each level of dream time slows down by 100 times, and then dog years go is 1/7. And it's like, if that is stupid and doesn't make sense, then your favorite movie is stupid too. So, like, it's like just somehow, like, the way, like, Rick is just so relentlessly, gleefully spiteful about it.
And yet, when he crawls into the window of Morty's teacher's house, he's like, uh-oh, spoilers, Morty. I'm a season behind.
Right, yeah. So it's like, so he's not above cares. Pop culture. Right. And this doesn't seem like a really particularly smart television show. Like, it's like very callback. Like, it's very, it's one of those like old, like mid-90s UPNs where it's got a very, or like, you know, it's Steve Urkel. Did I do that? You got a character with
catchphrases
and.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a time and place for dumb entertainment. Mr. Goldenfold, he works hard. He teaches a lot of dumb kids, and he gets home and he just wants to pass on in the couch and turn his brain off. So
I don't begrudge him watching the show. I think the thing that stands out to me is the sort of duality of Rick, you know, just like how he can hold kind of this one opinion on this other thing and this very different opinion on the thing in front of him that he likes. Yeah.
It's a good way to do kind of like very light but also pointed like culture commentary sometimes too, because like Rick, a lot of times on Rick and Morty, something will be like, for example, in this one, when they're going through the sex dungeon or the pleasure chamber, and Rick's like, come on, Morty, you gotta loosen up. You can't cause any waves because we'll be found out. And like, it's one of those things where like, I've observed this even among like sex positive people. It's all fun and games until you hit their squick button.
Yeah. Until somebody starts yiffing and then they're out.
Like, oh my God, it's like everything's cool except for like fuck furries, or everything's cool except for if you call me daddy, it's over. If everything's cool until find out this teacher in some hidden repressed level is sexualizing my sister / granddaughter, and then
she's hitting on me, this is not good.
And then like I love the centaur's line about you know, sexual hang-ups and or sexual shaming in the pleasure pit is punishable by death. It's all really, really funny. And then like the fact that they just incept, like, it's also, I thought that was brilliant too, that like you first start with the teacher and then you go to his favorite character from the TV show, then you incept into the centaur, the sex centaur, and then you try to incept into the scary dream girl, and then you hit, you know, dream bedrock where you've got Scary Terry. And the idea of what scares Scary Terry is like these, you know, very universal things.
Right.
And I also, it seems like one thing they were trying to suggest in his dream is that you've got this idea, like Scary Terry is kind of like, you know, he's this very young child and he's wild and free with the scares, but he's got the scare professor. And it's like trying to put him into the Nightmare on Elm Street box, you know?
Yeah, like, that bedrock sort of underlies everybody's dreams and fears and nightmares.
Yeah, because, like, you know, that's like, I don't very often have nightmares, but when I do, it surprisingly, it's always about, like, my guidance counselor calling me at 40 and saying, hey, we actually found out that you're a credit shy of graduating.
Oh, shit.
And you got to report to school to get your, like, and I'm like, what? It's always like super stressful. You know, I've never been like, you know what, fucker, keep your diploma. I'm 40 and it's never been an issue yet. Flip birds. But showing up with unprepared or with your pants off or when people are making fun of you. And that's like some primal shit. And it scares even Scary Terry. But also that like kind of gentle culture criticism I thought is also present in, like, you know, Scary Terry going home, and it's like, almost like a cop drama where he's bringing his home to work and, you know, his wife's asking him how he goes and he's like, you know, calls her a bitch and she's like, out there, not in here. And then he apologizes and it's like, yeah, you do the you do the subversion of like NYPD Blue, and then you also kind of show how it, but sometimes I wonder, does everyone read that as like what it, like the plain reading, which is like, yeah, it's funny to do this, but also it's wrong. And the end thing is, it's funny because you see Scary Terry and his wife being so wholesome, but that's not like ironically wholesome. Like that's the way things should be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a question. Like when you have these duality of characters, like where, I don't know if it encourages you to sort of draw your own conclusions, or if it's more trying to say that there's a little bit of that in all of us and we need to sort it out. I don't know. But I also like how they sort of bring Inception and tie the two main stories together here at the end, because we see that in order to get out of the predicament that he's created with Dog World, or whatever we're going to call it, Dog Dimension, he has to incept the dogs, right? So that kind of brings it back. And there's a lot of stuff around the B-plot here, what I would call the B-plot, with pet ownership and whether that's right and how far you can go with that. And I find all that pretty fascinating too. Not as someone who doesn't own any pets.
Yeah. I think the other thing that now that you mention it is like, that's also, they subvert the Inception thing. Cause the whole time Rick's like, you know, you got the trick of Inception is you got to make it seem like it's the other guy's idea, where the final Inception is literally Scary Terry as a rocket coming forward and screaming, this is all because you gave Morty bad grades, bitch.
I think they're just saying that this guy's a little dumb.
but like, but the super intelligent Snowball, he gets the actual Inception where they do it. Like they spend the whole year with him living in this dog dominated world and he's made Morty his pet, but then Morty gets cancer and now he understands the, you know, the
human pet relationship, right? From the other side. It's really good.
Yeah. And it is interesting. It is interesting because, you know, on the one hand, it's like, you know, no one should be cruel to their pets. No one should be cruel to animals. But it's an interesting ethical dilemma. Like, you know, we've taken, like Snuffles watching the wolf documentary, I thought was really funny, just in the juxtaposition of him, you know, with his intelligence kind of ramping up. And it's like a story of like, look at these perfect killers that are feared and we've taken them and we've turned them into these little things. And, you know, Snuffles is also, he's not the most impressive dog specimen. He's not a Rottweiler. He's not a pit bull. He's just a Bichon Frise or whatever. He's very fluffy and he's got a nice sparkling white coat. But he's super smart and he builds himself a battle. But like that just, you know, you saw like his face like take a hard edge. Where it's like, oh, damn it. This is what we're supposed to be running this shit.
Yeah.
And the whole, you know, when he goes in, you know, where's my testicles? Snuffles is my slave name. It's all pretty funny. But also pretty poignant too. Cause like, if dogs were suddenly intelligent, they'd have a lot of fucking, we'd have a lot of fucking explaining to do.
Absolutely. And it also comes at it from the other angle. The sort of duality of this is when Snuffles has Morty as a pet, he's going to every length to try and prolong his life, to try and save him, right? He's spending his kingdom into bankruptcy in order to do it. And I think there are a lot of pet owners out there like that too, who very much respect their pets, who very much love their pets, and would do anything for them.
Yeah, I wrote
above and beyond maybe what they would do for human beings in certain circumstances.
I avoid going to the doctor at all costs because it's so fucking expensive, but I at one time wrote a mid four figures check to fish a corn cob out of my dog's intestines. So I get it. I get it. I also thought that the idea of having a planet with intelligent dogs is a fun concept to have out there, because that's like, you know, that's floating out in the Rick and Morty universe. Like, will we ever see them again?
Yeah, so let me ask you, so they go through a portal, right? Mm-hmm. Created by Rick's portal gun.
Seems like it, yeah.
Interdimensional travel. I assume they're going to another dimension, which is like the smart dog dimension, where pet insurance is mandatory, as they say.
Yeah.
So I think that's another dimension that we're...
I mean, you're right. It could be... I mean, because I think Rick's portal gun does both. It can displace you in time or space or even dimensionally.
Hmm. Okay. It seems to be evidenced on screen that, yeah, that's the case.
Yeah. I mean, if he wants to be safe, I'd put him in another dimension so that they ever can't get back to this one in case they ever, you know, like, you know, Snowball, if he's ever deposed and a more ruthless warlord dog is put in, you don't want to, you don't want a dog ship in orbit over Earth.
No.
Wanting to destroy, wanting to castrate us all. But it's the idea of, like, where do you draw the line on pet ownership? Because, you know, we have hammered these dogs in these very malleable shapes, but, you know, a lot of people are asking questions about where's the line. Like, for example, New York State, I think just this week, banned declawing cats. And, like, now, like, docking dogs' tails and ears is becoming more and more gauche. And people are asking, like, certain breeds, like, do their muzzles have to be this short? These fuckers can't even breathe anymore. Or, like, they're having joint and back problems because their legs are too long, or their legs are too short and their body's too long. Like, it's one thing to custom design these species for our entertainment and amusement, but can we do it at the cost of their health and happiness and their ability to, like, function normally as a creature? And, you know, those are all great questions to above and beyond. Is it ethical to keep another animal as like a pleasure center? If we do that, what's the ethical lines? And, you know, it's, again, very light exploration of that idea, but I think it's a good idea to treat your pet in a way that if they suddenly gained super intelligence, started asking tough questions, you'd have good answers for them.
Human music. I like it.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hear the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now it's time for a segment we call Plot to the Future, where we gaze into the Dimension BM77, where we can view behind-the-scenes details, trivia, and spoilers for future episodes. Jim, what are you seeing through the portal?
There were a couple of things I had to look up in this episode. When they mentioned board-driven 11-minute episodes thing at the end, At first I thought, okay, that's just maybe a joke, but then I realized, no, it's probably an insider writing joke. And so I went and I looked it up, and apparently there are two schools of animation, story-driven and board-driven. Story-driven is very much like you write the whole story, you hand it off to the animators, they draw what's written on the page, product is done.
Sounds like traditional television or movie writing, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then there's board-driven animation, which is sort of more collaborative. You kind of break the plot. You send it over to the animators. They kind of come up with visual gags, and then you come together and sort of write the actual dialogue and what actually makes it to the screen.
Yeah. The way I understand it is, like, you give them, like, a couple bullet points of the major plot points. They kind of riff and go wild on the visuals, and then there's a smoothing out.
And you can absolutely see that this show is board-driven.
Sure.
Just the way that the visual gags integrate with the plot is top-notch. And the 11-minute part of that, I think you were saying – this is a tie-in to Justin Roiland's other
I think that this is because Adventure Time, I've heard, is exactly like that. First of all, the episodes are all 11 minutes long, and it's, you know, Justin Roiland is one of the guest starring voices on that show. And yeah, it's Adventure Time. I love it because I love watching it when my son was about 6 or 7 when it was, you know, first out, and we could watch it together because I got something from it because there's some adult humor that's like not like filthy adult, but like sometimes filthy adult, but sophisticated adult that goes over his head. But then there's also times where, like, you know, someone gets hot sauce dropped in their eye and they're screaming around, and it's like, that's, you know, you can laugh at as a 6-year-old, you can laugh at as a 36-year-old. But yeah, that's the reputation over there, is that Adventure Time is an 11-minute board-driven animated series. It's interesting because last commentary was pretty insightful. This one... the entertainment value is inversely proportionate to its insight and information, because not only was it seem like everyone was incapacitated, but they also mentioned that this was the second time they recorded the commentary for this episode, because the first one was so sloshed that they're like, oh, we can't.
How could it be any worse than this?
Yeah, because this was like every couple of minutes they would remember that they're supposed to be doing a commentary, and they'd get like 30 seconds into something, and then someone would drop
Dan would turn it into a joke about a beige wall, which provides no information, and that was the serious part, and then they go back to the beatbox.
And someone drops the beatbox, and it's suddenly like 80s, like they were saying, like it's, like the Fat Boys style, old school beatbox rap.
It's hilarious, but it's not informative.
The
only piece of information I got out of that entire commentary was that this was sort of two A plots that they MacGyvered it together.
Yeah.
And it actually worked pretty well, I thought, with the Inception stuff at the end. But This was not meant to be like, oh, here's our A plot, here's our B plot.
There was also a line that talked about like illustrating, you know, sexy summer.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, we're trying to beat the internet at their own game because we know like Rule 34 exists and there's going to be porn versions of all these characters. Yeah. So like right off the bat, episode two, boom, we've got a porn version of Summer. What are you going to do?
That's good. That's good stuff.
There's also kind of a, I thought this is a sly little reference because Snowball, you know, is the lead heroic pig character from Animal Farm who leads the revolution of animalism and is instrumental to driving off the humans and running the farm. And Kelsey Grammer, who is of, you know, obviously Cheers and the Frasier fame, voices Snowball in the 1999 film adaptation of Animal Farm. And he's the father of Spencer Grammer, who is the voice of Summer.
Nice.
So I thought it was an interesting little 360-degree Rick and Morty connection.
Yeah.
They also mention that... So they're making the joke about the it could be developed into a satisfying project. Yeah, I'd watch that for 11 minutes a pop. The board driven Adventure Time thing, but it turns out that Dog World, is a short that Justin Roiland had developed for Cartoon Network back in like 2012.
Yeah,
and I'd seen that before, and I had assumed it was something he did during the downtime between season one and season two of Rick and Morty, because it's got Rick and Morty music, it's animation style seems like it's very similar to like the animatics I've seen come out of the Rick and Morty studio.
It's very rough. It's just like storyboards, minor animations.
Yeah, it's literally like if you see the animatics from like the commentary, the DVD, the Blu-rays, rather. Actually, this predates Rick and Morty, and it donated its theme song to Rick and Morty for its theme song.
And it had to be the inspiration for the half of this episode that was the pets.
Oh, yeah. So you can that actually is readily available on the internet. I'm going to link to one of the copies if you want to see Dog World, because it's essentially kind of like expanded, interdimensional cable episode of it's like they blew up an interdimensional cable episode interlude into a whole like 15-minute short.
I would call it a grass is always greener type of story with, you know, humans as dog pets.
Right. One thing I wanted to talk about, kind of a follow-up from a discussion of yesterday about the question we had about Rick's Federation portal gun technology, because there's been a lot of fans that you know, has noticed the kind of incongruity of later episodes where everyone's after Rick's portal technology, but here you got interdimensional travel. A lot of fans pointed out that Rick had, like, initially the portal is blue, and then Rick, like, opens up the panel and does a whole bunch of shit to it, and then it turns green. So they're speculating that this, even though it's called interdimensional travel, it's actually just opening up a portal, like warp drive, which allows you, warp drive doesn't allow you to go to different dimensions. It uses an interdimensional kind of tunnel to rapidly move you from one place in the universe to another. So, like, the Federation has portal technology that can get you from one planet to the next, but you can't travel through time. You couldn't hop to different dimensions. And I felt like that is kind of tracks. It's weird that Rick called it the interdimensional customs.
Yeah.
But maybe he's just dumbing it down for Morty's sake, because it's not like you could see like if it's officially labeled as interdimensional customs in the episode because it's all alien languages.
I feel like if he were dumbing it down for Morty, he would have told Morty.
Right.
Like, you're too stupid to understand, so just think of it as interdimensional.
Right. This is just portal customs or intergalactic customs or something like that. But there's a little bit of and fans are famous for this, trying to figure out ways to get around retcons or like explain why the Klingons have vastly different foreheads in all the different series.
Right. In the commentary tracks, they just own it. They're just like, we didn't think of it.
Yeah.
It was the beginning of the thing.
It's a pilot,
it became something different. What do you want? Like, we're not prescient.
That's what I was able to gather through Portal BM7, the BM77.
Pickle Me This is distributed by Bald Move in association with Starburns Audio. It's produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch from Starburns, and myself, Mineron from Bald Move. All music featured on this podcast is from the Rick and Morty soundtrack, available from Sub Pop Records. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To discover the many other great shows we do, please check out baldmove.com and starburns.audio. If you appreciate what we do and want to directly support us, consider joining our club at club.baldmove.com to get access to exclusive bonus audio and video features. Finally, you can follow us on your favorite social media at Bald Move. See you next time.